KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in Radio West, we're talking about ghosts. The writer Colin Dickey has this new book full of ghost stories, stories in creepy hospitals and big mansions and old plantations. And it doesn't really matter if you believe in ghosts or not. Dickey doesn't much care about that part. He went around the country visiting all these haunted places because he wants to explain what ghost stories tell us about ourselves, our anxiety about death in the past, our attempts to deal with regret or grief, or just the stuff we can't explain. Join us in just a moment.
Do you work for the University of Utah? Are you a public radio nerd? Then donate to KUER through payroll deduction. Decide how much of your paycheck you'd like to put toward programming like Morning Edition, 1A, and Radio West, and the university will send your generous gift to KUER. Your contribution supports factual journalism, Utah stories, and even short films. Get started with payroll deduction by looking under the support tab at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For several years, the writer Colin Dickey traveled around the country listening for ghosts, is how he puts it in his book. And he found stories about ghosts pretty much everywhere. Nearly half of all Americans believe in ghosts. Nearly 30% say they've seen one or heard one or felt one. Dickey says there is not a city, a town, or village in this country that isn't crammed with spirits. And there's always at least one story about a crying woman or an old lady or a galloping horse. Dickey describes these ghost stories as dreams or maybe nightmares of a nation. They're where you can find uncomfortable truths or buried secrets or our sense of regret or guilt or grief. They're the uncomfortable expressions of the things we figured were long past. And he says ghosts are the Freudian slips of the whole community. Today in the program, Colin Dickey is joining us to talk about what he found in his journey. The book he wrote is called Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. Colin Dickey is a cultural historian and writer. His work has appeared in the Paris Review and the New Inquiry, among other journals and magazines. He's joining us today from a studio in New York City. And Colin Dickey, welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I guess I want to get this out of the way, because you kind of do, too, early on in the book. There's this author's note where you say that this book is not about the truth or the falsity about ghosts. You say some believe, some don't, but ultimately those questions kind of end up circling back on themselves. Just sort of make this point, if you would, why it doesn't necessarily matter, at least not to the point you're making in the book, whether there are ghosts or whether there aren't ghosts.
Yeah, I mean, I realized early on that if you are someone who believes in ghosts, there's probably no amount of evidence or scientific debunking I can offer you that will prove to you that ghosts don't exist. And the converse is also true. If you don't believe in ghosts, there is no amount of spectacular supernatural evidence I can present to you that will change your mind. You'll find some way to rationalize it as a, you know, hallucination or something like that. And yeah. So rather than trying to fight that battle, which on either end I found to be kind of unwinnable, I decided to kind of sidestep it altogether. And I think the conclusion I came to is that most of us are probably not on fully 100% on either end of that spectrum. Most of us, I think, are somewhere in the middle. And the more people I talked to, the more I saw this. I saw people who were diehard atheists, but, you know, had seen a ghost.
Yeah.
Absolutely, 100%. And, yep. You know, and I also saw people who were devout believers in ghosts, but who, you know, no matter what they saw or felt, they found some way to rationalize it or explain it away. And I think I was more interested in that middle ground and trying to figure out how you could make a space for that kind of ambiguity and tie it to sort of, you know, history in the past rather than try and tie it to some kind of evidentiary exploration of the paranormal.
So what was the original idea that got you started with the book? What was the sort of the nut that you wanted to kind of figure out?
Well, it started with me. I grew up in San Jose, California. I grew up near the Winchester Mystery House, and some of your listeners may know this place. It is the story in brief is basically that Sarah Winchester's father-in-law, Oliver Winchester, had founded the Winchester Rifle Company, and she inherited a great deal of wealth, but lost both her infant daughter and her husband early on. and never remarried, never had any other kids. And according to the story, became convinced that her family was cursed, and particularly cursed by anybody who had ever been killed by a Winchester rifle. And supposedly a psychic told her that the way to keep them at bay would be to build a house that was never finished. Yeah. So the Winchester Mystery House is just a fascinating, beautiful, beautiful building. It is a 160-room Victorian mansion that has no rhyme or reason to its layout. It feels like a labyrinth. You're just sort of lost in it. I mean, you take a guided tour, but you get easily overwhelmed by the sprawling scope of it. And I just, you know, I grew up in kind of a normal suburban house where everything was ordered and neat. And I just, by my imagination was always captivated by this labyrinth-like house just nearby. And so that kind of planted the seeds, I think, very early on that I wanted to explore sort of how these stories develop around a place like that and what they mean.
It's interesting how much the story is about architecture. You talk about how how a building can feel alive and settling because of its age or something, you know, something odd about its construction, like the way, and you tell that, I wanted you to talk about this too. You write about when you and your wife went looking for houses in 2008 and you found all these, it was in the Los Angeles area. So there were a lot of sort of weird adaptations and connections and, renovations, and they were altered in these weird kinds of ways. So talk about the architecture part of this, because I found this really interesting.
Right. I mean, yeah, the Sarah Winchester part was kind of the first half. And the second half was, you know, as you mentioned, we were looking for a home. And, you know, L.A., particularly in Hollywood, you know, all these buildings date from the 20s and 30s, or a lot of them do. But they have been adapted and built up over time, and often in really strange ways. I mean, yeah. It's not that somebody, you know, hires an architect and pays for blueprints and does something nice. Often it's somebody hires a friend of a friend who goes down to Home Depot, buys a bunch of lumber, and just slaps on an extra room. And it's, you know, some of those places are really fascinating and fun, and some of them are idiosyncratic and exciting, and other ones are very strange. And I had never really thought about that until we started that process, this idea that, you know, we grow up with certain expectations of how homes are going to be laid out. And when they confound those expectations, it can often feel quite unsettling, even if we don't immediately recognize that's what's going on. I mean, to walk into a house where the bathroom is in the front of the house, is that, you know, there's nothing architecturally wrong with that, except it just feels a little strange, you know, things like that. So that's what I got really sort of interested in, this relationship we have to the architectural spaces that we inhabit.
It's interesting. You mentioned in a couple of places in the book the sort of famous story of the Amityville Horror, which a lot of us know of that one. And you say that a haunted house is a house which is supposed to be homey and welcoming, but it's become emptied out of its true function.
Right. And again, I mean, this idea that we have, I think, as humans, sort of evolved over the years that we come to expect certain things from homes.
Yeah.
We expect them to sort of have a certain layout, to do certain things. And sort of through wear and habitation, we have come to expect those things to a point where we don't even really articulate them. And right, this idea of the uncanny, the sort of Freudian notion of the uncanny, which I got really excited about and found really useful in sort of talking about this. And the German word is unheimlich, which means, literally it means unhomely. So heimlich means, you know, homely, comfortable, familiar, normal, safe. And then the unheimlich would be the opposite of that.
Yeah.
And so this idea of, you know, the house that should be homey, but for some reason is not, you know, that's the kind of idea of the uncanny house, is that there's something about it that has confounded our notions of what a house and what a home should look like and how it should feel.
You also write about how old buildings are haunted by memories, too. And I wanted to ask you about this because you say we're conditioned to conflate memory and physical space. So we're also connected. Our memories are connected to staircases and weird rooms. And so I think this is how you put it in the book. We kind of give this psychic value to the places we inhabit.
Right. I mean, again, I mean, think about your childhood home. I mean, how many hours you spent just sitting in your room, daydreaming, sitting in the hallway, playing with toys, imagining a landscape sort of larger than the house you're in. This idea that we project our kind of hopes and fears and memories and history onto these inanimate walls is something sort of innate in human culture. And any place that I think you've spent a long time in will have those memories. If you've, you know, I mean, I moved around a lot when I was a kid, but to go back in a home where I've spent a lot of time as a child is always that sort of, you know, shocking, nostalgic, you know, I guess something out of Marcel Proust, that moment where you're suddenly sort of like thrown back into all these memories and all these kind of fantasies that you once had there and are brought back to you. And so, right. So, I mean, this is something that I found to be kind of an innate part of human culture, but one that we don't always articulate or say out loud. And I wanted to kind of get that into the book and sort of explore the way in which haunted houses kind of give us a way, you know, the rhetoric of the haunted house gives us a way to talk about that stuff.
I guess it was easy to find haunted places, right? I mean, they're everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And in fact, early on in the book, I had to start cutting myself off because, you know, once you tell people that you're writing a book on haunted houses, everybody has a story, everybody has a place, everybody knows something about something. And I mean, it was a great process of just gathering up all these stories and listening to all these people and, you know, Googling, you know, most haunted cemetery, most haunted hotel, and just sort of gathering up these great lists of all the various haunted places. And then, you know, I mean, I could have written a book that, you know, was 10,000 pages long and would have taken me 20 years. And I kind of had to kind of stop at some point and figure out how to kind of manage it into a smaller number.
But how did you know when you were like, this was the story that relates to something I want to write about? Because you say there were times when it wasn't always clear why you were drawn to a particular place. So how did you choose the things that you wanted to write about in these stories?
Yeah, I wanted to make sure that each story that I was telling was more than just here's a haunted house and here is the true story behind the haunting. I wanted it to speak to some larger idea, some larger cultural point, and the stories that I tried to gather up were ones that I felt told a bigger story, you know, opened up on a bigger picture than themselves. And so you know, to go back to the Winchester House, I mean, that is a story ultimately about how we view women, particularly wealthy women who don't remarry, who don't reenter into society. Yeah. And, you know, it's a story about our relationship to firearms. And those are both kind of huge kind of cultural issues that get compacted into this kind of funny ghost story.
Have we always had ghost stories in human culture, human history? Do we know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can go all the way back. I mean, I opened the book with Pliny the Younger, the Roman writer. And he in one of his letters to a friend, he's basically asking, you know, what do you think about ghosts? So here's a story about this guy named Athenodorus. Mm-hmm. And Athenodorus bought this house and he got it cheap because it was haunted. You know, everybody knew it was haunted. And Athenodorus, he's a philosopher. He doesn't care about any of that. So he buys this house, but he's being bothered by this ghost. This ghost wakes him up in the middle of the night every night and he can't get any sleep. And finally he decides he's going to wait up for the ghost. And, you know, the ghost appears and he's rattling chains and he's making all this noise. And Athenodorus is, I think, in the middle of a sentence that he's working on. So he kind of holds up his finger to the ghost to tell him to wait, which I think is a great little detail.
That's a great little detail.
Yeah. just hang on. You can do the haunting in a second, right. But I got to get this idea down, you know? Yeah. And so, but then he follows the ghost out to the backyard and the ghost kind of points to a spot and then disappears. And Athenodorus digs at the spot and lo and behold, he finds the human remains of somebody who, you know, who was murdered there and didn't get a proper burial. And so Athenodorus,
the skeleton in chains, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Right. And so he gives him the proper burial and the ghost goes away. And this is, you know, the first century AD. So this is a pretty old story. And yet it reads almost exactly like a modern day Scooby-Doo story. I mean, it's really got all the same elements there. So it's really something that we have had with us for as long as there's been recorded history.
Is that part of these stories, that there's something unresolved? I mean, you've got this ghost who is trying to get Athenodorus's attention to, like, give me a proper burial. Like, there's something unresolved. Is that sounds like a motif in all these stories, or most of them, or many?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, well, certainly Hamlet opens with Hamlet's ghost saying, you know, I was murdered and my murder goes unavenged. Yeah, I mean, you find that over and over again. And what's fascinating about that particular sort of stereotypical story about hauntings is after a while it becomes clear that it's really not necessarily about the paranormal. It's really about our ideas about justice and law, and this idea that, like, I think we want to hold on to the idea that even if something terrible happens and we don't get justice in this life, we'll get a mulligan. We'll be able to come back, you know, after we're gone and convince some young person to investigate the truth and do the right thing. And so ghost stories are a really convenient way for us to engage with questions about justice and injustice and how we move forward through history, knowing that justice isn't always served.
So if you were to imagine what's going on, you know, in the human subconscious as humans create these ghost stories, would you say that in many cases we're kind of, whether we're conscious of it or not, we're kind of working out something that's irritating our minds? We feel guilty about racism. We feel guilty, and we'll talk about this later, or we feel guilty about slavery, or we feel some unresolved anxiety about class, or, I mean, the list is endless, and we can talk about these as we go, but is that something that's irritating our sort of human subconscious that we're working out?
I think in a lot of cases that's really true. I mean, obviously, again, there are people for whom this is just a supernatural phenomenon. There's nothing deeper. It's just the existence of ghosts. Fine.
Yeah.
But I think for most of us, ghosts are a way for us, at least ghost stories are a way for us to negotiate things that we don't have an easy language to get at otherwise. And so, so for a lot of people, I think that the language of ghosts and hauntings and ghost stories are a way for them to confront mortality and just, you know, both their own mortality and those that they've loved that they've lost. That this idea that, you know, it is comforting to know that, you know, my mother or my grandmother or whomever is still with me and still I have some sort of, you know, connection to her or whomever. You know, I mean, that's just a way of sort of negotiating our relationship to loss. And so that's one thing ghost stories do. But you're right. They also are an important way for us to keep alive kind of unresolved issues of history. And that's what I kept coming back to in this book and sort of the way in which American history is structured and how we kind of on the surface tell ourselves one story about how America came to be the country it is today. But the ghost stories that we tell often kind of reveal a little bit of an anxiety about that grand narrative and poke at some of the stuff at the margins.
This is the idea, as I mentioned, that ghost stories are Freudian slips of communities.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Because it's difficult to hold together, I think, any kind of narrative that is sort of homogenous and only tells one story, and particularly since history is made up of so many differing voices. And so if your voice doesn't get expressed through that main narrative, sometimes ghost stories can be a way to get that story back out.
Let me have you tell one more ghost story before we head to a break, because you write about how ghosts kind of change their shape. Different eras, you get different versions of ghosts. And there's one example you write about early in the book, where you have this ghostly horse galloping down a street in the village of Leeds, New York, and the horse is dragging a young woman. Tell that story and talk about how that sort of changes over time.
Right. So as you say, it's this ghostly horse that drags this woman that kind of runs through the main street of town on, you know, various dark nights, and it's local legend. And it's a story that has, as far as I know, been around for a couple hundred years. That's just the ghost of Leeds, New York. And the best most people can say about its origins is that there was a master of a house who had a servant girl who, you know, made some minor infraction, messed up in some tiny way. And he was sort of overly harsh and brutal and decided to punish her in this way, you know, this horrific way that ended up killing her, of tying her to a horse and, you know, setting off the horse, galloping through the middle of town, dragging her behind it. And so, you know, so that's how this poor servant girl died. And now she haunts the town. But, you know, over the years, different tellers have used that basic story to emphasize different things about American history. So in the 1850s, there's an abolitionist writer who tells that ghost story, except it's not a servant girl. She's an African slave. And again, this idea of this story of this cruel master who, you know, does this horrifically brutal thing to this young woman is an indictment of slavery and the evils of slavery. But then, you know, 30, 40 years later, after the Civil War, a different writer comes along and tells that same story. But this writer is far more interested in socialism and class mm-hmm. issues. And so she's no longer, you know, an enslaved person from Africa. She's now a European immigrant, and she's being cruelly treated by one of the members of the aristocracy. And so the story has this kind of melodramatic kind of base that allows itself to be adapted to whatever injustice happens to be going on at that time. And different writers have emphasized different aspects in order to you know, make certain points about America.
Colin Dickey is with us. His book is called Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. We need to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. You really need to go check out our latest short at Radio West Films. It's one of those stories that I'll ruin if I say too much. I'll just say that the way the human brain responds to trauma sometimes is just crazy. We met Gwen Berry while she was visiting family here a few weeks ago, and the way she told us what had happened to her will blow you away. We're calling the film Miss Me, I'm Irish. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about ghosts. The writer Colin Dickey is with us. His book is full of ghost stories in creepy old hospitals and big mansions and brothels and old plantations. And it doesn't really matter if you believe in ghosts or not. Dickey doesn't much care about that part. He went around the country visiting haunted places because he wanted to explain what ghost stories tell us about ourselves. This book is called Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. So what do you, you talk to a lot of ghost hunters along the way. What do you make of these ghost hunter types who have, you know, the TV shows, they go around to these old houses, they bring with them these tape recorders to collect these, you know, EVPs, these electronic voice phenomena. What do you make of that part of the story?
You know, for the book, I interviewed a lot of different ghost hunters. I interviewed pretty much anybody who would talk to me. And whenever I would go to a city, you know, I would try and hit up as many different, you know, psychics and mediums and paranormal investigators that I could just to, you know, hear, you know, how they did things in their town and how ghost hunters in New Orleans were different than those in L.A. And what I found above all is that everybody is different. Everybody who does this, I think, has different kinds of motivations. And you know, I talked to one guy for whom ghost hunting was a way to get in touch with the past. It was a way to understand the history of, you know, a minor hotel here or a weird house over here, something that was never going to get written up in the history books. But, you know, he could use the ghost stories to kind of drive him to understand maybe the history of a specific building. And I met another guy for whom ghosts were a function of wormholes. And, you know, and so for him, ghosts were an attempt to prove a very specific scientific theory. And it had nothing to do with, you know, the paranormal or life after death or anything like that. But he was using ghost hunting and the same techniques that everybody else was using. But he was using it to accomplish a very specific scientific goal. And so, you know, so I found people who were, you know, maybe their motives were a little less pure, who were, you know, thought they could make a quick buck or maybe get on TV. And, you know, I mean, I think in some ways those guys are maybe the most popular or most prominent images that we see. And I kind of feel like that's a shame because in the end, what I found was that for most people that I talked to, you know, ghost hunting, even if it was sometimes cheesy and sometimes a little, you know, maybe seemed a little ridiculous to outsiders, it was really a way for people, and it still is a way for people to get in touch with a something that is larger than themselves, you know, whether that is, you know, reaching across the divide of life and death, whether that was understanding, you know, a piece of the past that they didn't understand in any other way or, you know, whatever it was. This was something like, you know, something like a spiritual event for most people I talked to. And I felt that was worth, you know, acknowledging, even if there were a couple people who maybe had less noble goals.
Yeah, and it's also, you write about how these EVPs that you sometimes hear. I mean, you go online, you can hear tons of them. And if you hear someone saying, you know, whispering, "Get out," or whatever, if it doesn't have a story or a tale connected to it, you talk about in the book how that's kind of tenuous. It's fragile. I mean, it's the story or the tale that grounds the event. You can't just, I mean, it may sound kind of creepy, but if there's no backstory to it, if there's no history to it, it doesn't have the same meaning as a ghost story.
Right. I mean, again, you find this over and over again. You find people who say, "Oh, well, I felt something, or I saw something. I saw a little flash of blue light, or I heard a voice on me, or it felt like somebody was, whispering in my ear, and I turned around and no one was there." And these, again, I found these stories to be quite common, even among people who wouldn't otherwise say that they are believers in ghosts. But those stories by themselves just kind of hover in the air. They don't really go anywhere. But if you're in a place and you say, "Well, I just saw, you know, I just saw something I can't understand," and somebody else comes along and say, "Oh, well, you know, a terrible murder happened in this house 20 years ago," suddenly those two things connect, yeah. Right? You know, suddenly now you have a story to attach to the moment, and it kind of grounds it. Well, all right, maybe that's what I saw. Maybe that's who it was.
Right.
You know, and so these things kind of feed off each other, and if you don't have both of them, then one of them tends to atrophy and die.
Tell us about the merchant's house in Lower Manhattan. This is a story, Gertrude Treadwell. It was said sort of set aside her love and her life to fulfill her father's wishes. He wanted her to stay close by. He wanted her to live in the house.
Right.
Tell us about this one. I liked the architecture that you mentioned in this story, by the way. You talk about creaking floors and old wood, as you put it, thick with humidity. This is one where the kind of sense of place really comes through, I think.
Right. And again, I mean, I was lucky enough the night we took a ghost tour, it was one of those sort of late spring, early summer nights in New York City where it's raining, but it's kind of warm and humid. There is that kind of literal electricity in the air. And once you're in a, you know, supposedly haunted place, then that, you know, your hairs are already kind of on end.
Right.
And, you know, it just kind of feeds that sensation. But yeah, I mean, the Merchant's House Museum was built in the 1830s or 40s. I can't quite remember now. But it's one of the last surviving, I guess it's the last surviving building in Manhattan that has its original furniture, or the oldest, you know, such building. And so it's this real snapshot in time. And the guy who built it, his daughter, Gertrude Treadwell, lived there her entire life. She never married. She was in her 90s when she died. And shortly after she died, she was the last occupant in the house. This is the 1930s. It was turned into a museum. And so for decades, it's just been this kind of, you know, snapshot of 19th century New York life and a, you know, kind of cultural museum that you could tour. But in the past, I'd say 15, 20 years, the management kind of stopped downplaying all of these weird ghost stories associated with it and started embracing it and sort of, you know, especially now that the Merchant's House Museum is more and more anachronistic, it's less and less in place in a downtown Manhattan that's just surrounded by, you know, concrete and glass and steel, and it looks stranger. And I'm sure there are developers who would jump at the chance to, you know, have their way with prime real estate like that. And so it the more anachronistic it is in Lower Manhattan, I think the more that people respond to these ideas that it's haunted.
It's interesting. You see in this story, you write about kind of ideas and anxieties about women and modernity and domesticity. Gertrude has a brother who also sort of appears as a ghost, I guess, now, Samuel Treadwell, supposedly the black sheep of the family. Would you just talk about that? Because you say that in some ways this is also a reflection of the American family, these ghost stories. Like he was the guy who didn't live up to concepts of masculinity, so now he's appearing as a ghost.
Right, yeah. And again, I mean, the Treadwell sort of family, I mean, the Samuel Treadwell, the guy who founded it, who built the house, you know, is this kind of rags-to-riches kind of mercantile guy who builds a very successful business and then retires with this very nice, stately little townhome. And his children kind of embody the kind of gothic melodramatic stereotypes of, as you say, you know, the black sheep who never amounts to anything and wastes his father's money, and the spinster daughter who never marries and stays at home. And, you know, that is in part based in history. And there are stuff to substantiate that, but over time these aspects get a little heightened, because again, I think that the stories about the merchant house are really about how we feel about certain families that don't look like the American norm, how we feel about women who stay at home and don't get married and don't have children and don't fulfill that kind of role of the domestic mother. I mean, we as a culture broadly, I think, are still sort of struggling with, placing women who are sort of finding a place for women who don't fit those molds. And so when we have these ghost stories, they are a way of expressing our, I think, anxiety about women who don't fit these kind of expected stereotypes, so that the woman who doesn't marry is somehow sort of weird and perverse and unsettling and unnerving. And so that's how she sort of comes back as this ghost, that she never really leaves the house. And so yeah, I mean, I think that the more that you kind of add up all these stories, again and again, you see them as ways for us to kind of touch upon these moments in sort of cultural and social history that we find a little bit uncomfortable, and we sort of give them ghost stories to kind of explore them while keeping them at arm's length.
What is the deal with all of these ghost stories that happen in places that are supposedly built over the graves of indigenous people? Tons of these.
Right. And that was, again, when I started the book, sort of making a list of ghost stories, and immediately that comes to the forefront of everybody's mind. I mean, we've talked a little bit about Amityville before, this house in Long Island that was supposedly quite haunted and supposedly built on an Indian burial ground, and that's for me a very sort of straightforward expression of a certain kind of American anxiety. This idea that you and your happy suburban family, you have just bought your dream home and it's lovely and you paid for it with your hard-earned money and you own the land that it's on. But there's this kind of nagging sensation in the back of your mind that on some sense, us, specifically white Americans, don't actually own the land that we are living on, that there are other people who have a previous claim to it. And so this idea of the Indian burial ground, I mean, I'd assume that I'd be able to find it, stretching all the way back to the 18th century. And there are little hints of it early on. But what I found really fascinating is that it's really not until the 1970s and the 1980s that the cliche of the Indian burial ground becomes so popular in American pop culture. And when I started to do the research, I mean, one thing that came up is that in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a pretty famous major court case, which I didn't know anything about until I did the research. But at the time, involving the state of Maine and the Passamaquoddy Band of Indians and a couple other indigenous tribes who were suing over a contract that had ceded a bunch of the state of Maine to the United States government that was basically void, was invalid. And so there was a moment in time in which the state of Maine was facing the reality that they were going to have to cede 60% of the land of Maine back to the Passamaquoddies. And, ultimately it was negotiated with a cash payment. I think they paid the indigenous tribes about $80 million to resolve this. But there's this actual literal moment in American history where indigenous Americans are basically saying, we own this land that you have built these houses on. And at the same time, suddenly in sort of white American pop culture, this idea of the Indian burial ground suddenly becomes a really compelling ghost story to tell.
Latent anxiety about
that we have.
And so I'm wondering, I was thinking about, gosh, that South Dakota pipeline story that's playing out right now. It has that also has sort of the element in it where basically white America stole land from Native Americans. And it makes you wonder if this, seeing this story play out in headlines, whether there will be a ghost story that sort of comes or something like that. You know, just how these stories that we see today somehow make them make their way, however they do, into ghost stories later.
Right. And the thing about the Indian Burial Ground, you know, ghost story is it's a way of engaging with those questions without actually having to resolve it. Because, of course, right. you know, Amityville, Pet Sematary, all those stories, the answer is never for the white family to give up and walk away. It's always to, you know, somehow defeat the ghosts and prove that they are, in fact, mm-hmm. the rightful owners of this land. So, it's a story that both combines a certain amount of, I guess, sort of latent anxiety or guilt, but also at the same moment kind of reestablishes a certain, superiority over Indigenous people. And so that, I think, also accounts for why it's so popular, is because it touches with something which is sort of fraught in our history without mm-hmm. actually, you know, admitting any guilt or, you know, owing any reparations, which I think is another thing that seems to come up a lot in these kinds of stories.
I wanted you write about the history of the spiritualist tradition, and it's really fascinating. I hadn't realized how spiritualism emerges to kind of challenge all these traditional things like the patriarchy and traditional marriage, and what a factor it plays in the movement of, you know, women trying to get the vote and those kinds of things. Let's talk about this, because you say that our fascination as a country with ghosts begins right around 1848, something like that.
Yeah, it begins in 1848. It begins with the Fox sisters, who are these two teenage girls in upstate New York who announce that they are able to communicate with a spirit in their house. Yeah. And the spirit will answer questions with a series of raps. So, you know, they will say to the empty room, you know, how old are you? And then there will be this rapping noise that will count off, you know, 37 or 38, however old he is. And these the Fox sisters become the first moment in which spiritualism, this idea that we can have direct communication with the dead in this kind of non-threatening and non-religious, just sort of, you know, direct one-to-one correspondence kind of takes off. And so within a couple of years, spiritualism has just taken over the country. I mean, there's circles everywhere. There are mediums offering their services. And eventually the Fox sisters are unmasked that they're able to make this rapping noise by sort of cracking their toe joints or something like that. And you know, one of them sort of announces that she, you know, that the whole thing is a hoax and that she apologizes, but everybody turns on her and she basically has to recant her apology within a year, because, you know, at this point it's become such an important part of American culture that they need it to be true. And I grew up knowing about spiritualists. I mean, certainly you see them in horror movies, and yeah. you know, it's always this kind of like kooky, oh, look at those 19th century people who believed in really silly stuff like, you know, spirit photographs and table rappings and all that stuff, and it's all just, you know, frauds and pranksters and whatnot. But right, as I started to actually sort of delve into the history, you know, a couple things came to light, and the first of which is that, you know, spiritualism is really the first major women's movement in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's really the thing about spiritualism is that it's a spirituality that is divorced from traditional religion, yeah. where in the traditional, you know, traditional Christian religions primarily, but also, you know, Jewish and Islam, all of the spirituality is mediated by men. So, yeah. you know, you have to have the priest, you have to, you know, so women's religious lives were always mediated by men, and particularly in these sort of patriarchal and kind of, you know, oppressive kind of ways. And so spiritualism comes along and it says, you know, anybody can talk to the dead. You know, all you need is to be, you know, have an open mind. And this taps into this real need, I think, you know, all people, but particularly women have that, you know, spirituality shouldn't necessarily be something that is mediated by another human being, that we ought to be able to have a sort of direct line to the other world. And so that's part of the reason why it becomes popular. I mean, it's also, I mean, when you think about the kind of archetypal spiritual medium, you know, someone, you know, is a woman who sort of, you know, goes into fits and speaks in tongues and sort of does all this outrageous behavior. I mean, this is precisely the kind of behavior that would get you institutionalized in a hospital for quote unquote hysteria. And yet in a spiritualism context, I mean, it is valorized. It's proof that you are worthy and that you have some deep connection that the rest of us don't have. And so spiritualism is this major, important movement that, you know, feminism will later look back and say, you know, this led almost directly to, you know, the right to vote and a host of other, you know, major women's causes sort of grew out of this movement, which gave women a voice and allowed them to sort of speak before audiences and took them seriously. And, you know, this whole host of things that were really important that grew out of this early movement.
Let's talk about the Cathedral Park ghost story. What's fascinating about this one, this is the story of this woman named Thelma Taylor. It's fairly recent, this story. A true story. And not as embellished and not as packed with kind of false embellishments as some of the others. That's what I found really interesting about this one. But set this up for us. Tell us the story of the Cathedral Park ghost.
Yeah, so this is Portland, Oregon, and on the north end of Portland, Oregon, there's a beautiful old green bridge, as I think it's copper, called the St. John's Bridge, and it's sort of looks like almost like a miniature Golden Gate Bridge, except it's, you know, a different color. And on the east bank, beneath the bridge, there is this really lovely little park that they have built, but it's an odd park because the bridge is sort of towering over you at all points, and the wind is kind of howling through the bridge struts, and there are all these signs saying, you know, watch for falling objects, they could kill you. And so you're trying to have a picnic while, you know, this kind of monstrosity is like sort of lurching above you. And, you know, and so of course it's haunted, and, you know, and kids go there all the time, and paranormal investigators go there all the time looking for ghosts, and who they're looking for is a woman named Thelma Taylor. And Thelma Taylor was a 16-year-old girl who, in 1949, was hitchhiking to do summer agricultural work and was picked up by a guy who kidnapped her and then later murdered her. Yeah. And so her murderer was caught. He was executed. And that sort of, you would think, would be the end of the story. But people continue to think that Thelma Taylor is still down there and she's still haunting the place. What I found really fascinating and kind of, you know, in a way heartbreaking is that, unlike a lot of these ghost stories where you imagine, you know, it's a, you know, Civil War soldier or a Victorian lady or something like that, you know, Thelma Taylor's sister is still alive. Her sister was three years old when her older sister was abducted and killed. And, you know, this is not for her some fun, kooky ghost story that you tell to creep out your friends. This is, you know, a personal tragedy that happened in her life that she spent, you know, her and her mother and you know, spent a lot of their life trying to deal with and trying to get over. And, you know, again, I mean, I think we think of ghost stories as being, you know, arising out of tragedy and arising out of terrible things in the past. And that's what kind of gives them their kind of their edge and their excitement and their, you know, the kind of little jolt that you get in the middle of the night telling them. But it's also, that means that there's actually people on the other end of that tragedy. Mm-hmm. And so I, you know, I talked to Thelma Taylor's sister and I, you know, just hearing her sort of, you know, describe to me the way that, you know, her mother had, you know, would never let her go anywhere by herself, basically, as she grew up, you know, and, you know, this is a woman who, you know, is now in her 70s, I guess. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about the day that, you know, her mother sort of showed her the newspaper account of Thelma Taylor's killer's execution, you know, and pointing to it and saying, you know, she's, you know, he's never going to harm anybody ever again. And you know, the 7-year-old woman talking about a thing that happened decades ago is, you know, in tears with me on the phone. And it's sort of a, you know, it was a hard moment to sort of get my head around, but a real reminder that these ghost stories actually come from somewhere and they come from people's lives.
Well, and there's a man you meet named Eric Meharry who, this is only 4 years ago, makes a Facebook page for Thelma Taylor.
Right. Yeah, he was a guy who he was working for the coroner's office. So, you know, and just kind of knew this story, got a little fascinated with it, would spend his lunch hours, you know, going down to the library, the courtroom, kind of seeing what else he could find about it. And he makes this Facebook page that just says, you know, Thelma Taylor is the name of it. And, you know, he just kind of posts his findings, and he has a small following. And then one day he gets this Facebook message out of the blue that just says, you know, Thelma Taylor was my sister, and who are you? You know, and, you know, it was this kind of, for Eric, a really shocking moment, although they, you know, I mean, he's a thoughtful and really intelligent guy. And so, you know, has developed this friendship with Taylor's sister, you know, in the years since. But, you know, again, it's this idea that just because it's sort of cool and fun doesn't necessarily mean that there's not somebody for whom it has totally different meanings.
Well, you write about how a few years ago Facebook sent you one of those notes where they suggest you, hey, you should reconnect with your friend, and this particular friend had died.
Right, exactly.
And you write about how seeing her face was never not jarring. So it's kind of a, I don't know, is it crass to say it was kind of a modern sort of haunting on some level?
Oh, no. I mean, I think that's exactly what it is and what I try to get at in the book. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, this friend of mine, her face showing up on my Facebook feed, it's not, you know, I don't view it as a paranormal experience.
Sure.
Where she is reaching out from the grave. But it is very much an idea that, particularly with our current state of social media and the algorithms that are sort of more and more running our lives. I mean, those algorithms do a very poor job of understanding human mortality and human grief and human loss. And so they're not coded for, and they're not equipped to help us understand death and navigate it. And so we're going to continue to have this ongoing issue with technology, where technology is going to be the person who brings up the uncomfortable thing that, you know, because it doesn't know any better. And so it's going to continue to say, oh, well, you know, what about that friend that you used to hang out with? And you're going to have to, you know, that friend who died and, you know, and whose loss you're not over yet, but who, you know, Facebook, Twitter, they don't know that. They just know that this person isn't engaging on their platform anymore.
You know, this Eric person told you that a lack of information is part of the recipe for ghost stories. That the less information you have, the more these stories kind of evolve and grow. So what happens? Like, I guess, what's the future of ghost stories? If you have science that has figured this out, that can explain, we didn't have a lot of time to talk about this, but you write about how science is dealing with and helping understand phenomena we figured was so mysterious. In fact, is probably a manifestation of our own minds. There's science to explain
right.
all of that. So if it's all sort of explained away, not only does it kind of take the fun out of it, does it also take the important elements of ghost stories out of it? I mean, because that Eric Meharry says that information is killing ghost stories. And is that a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I love that he said that, although in the end, I found myself disagreeing with that.
Yeah.
I mean, partly because so a lot of ghost experiences, I think you can safely say, evolve out of, you know, old buildings as they fall apart. You know, so a building that stood for a couple hundred years is going to creak weird.
Yep.
Doors are going to close on their own. You know, and that's just sort of architecture slowly breaks down.
Right.
You know, and that's just a fact. That's going to be true, again, of our online architecture.
Yeah.
So, you know, if Facebook and Twitter and, you know, Instagram are the sort of social meeting places, they are the architecture where we live our lives now. I mean, those are going to slowly break down over time too. I mean, you know, try logging on to, I don't know, you know, MySpace
right.
or Friendster or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, and what you see is like, oh my gosh, all my friends are 20 years younger or 15 years younger, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, it's so we're still going to be surrounded by failing architecture, even if that architecture is digital.
Mm.
And it's still going to create these kind of uncanny experiences one way or another. And that's going to continue to be part of our lives, you know, going forward.
Well, you say we'll probably never dispel the ghosts in the machine because we need them. And I want to ask you this finally. You say in the book that we're going to have to replace ghosts, or at least as they keep changing, we have to replace them with some viable cultural conversation that gives us a way to have these meaningful ways of talking about the past and understanding death. So what do ghosts look like in the future? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's the ghost story, and this is the conclusion I kept coming back to, is such a efficient narrative for talking about so many different things about death, about architecture, about the past, about ourselves. There's so many different things you can pack into the ghost story that it seems highly unlikely that we will abandon it just because a couple scientists have figured out, you know, where hallucinations come from in the brain. You know, I mean, that's just, you know, we need that narrative. We need that way of negotiating our relationship to the world around us in this very specific set of ways. And that is going to continue going forward, I think.
Colin Dickey, his book is Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places. He joined us from New York City. Colin, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thanks for having me on. This has been really fun.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Susan Anderson and Emily Anderson. Technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.